Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Jamila Rice. Jamila Rice is a Homewood native, Milken Award-winning English teacher, book blogger, author, stalker, and Roku enthusiast. Jamila Rice has been fascinated with writing since she taught herself cursive at three, quickly shaping all the swear words she could recall. A 2013 Western Pennsylvania Writing Project Fellow, Jamila hopes to continue writing herself in and out of Anne Shirley-esque scrapes, squeezing a bit of salsa and sewing in between. Hi, Jamila. Welcome to Prosody.
Hi, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to have you on. So do you want to begin by reading us some of your work?
Yes, I'm going to start with a nonfiction piece entitled Learning Cursive. And here it goes. 547 Morgan Street was the first address of my life, although I don't remember it as such. I do remember it as my initial institution of learning. It was there that I learned how to scale and gut newly caught fish, how to listen for the sound of fried chicken's doneness, how to read dreams and listen to ghosts who sometimes visit in the night, how to pull the right weeds from between prized yellow rose bushes, how to Charleston and boogie woogie to ancient brittle recordings, how to adapt Barnaby Jones's and Columbo's deductive reasoning to solve life's mysteries, and how to love learning itself. Resting near the top of its peak in the Upper Hill District of Pittsburgh, the three-story, two-bedroom, brick and white siding-clad home had been in my family since the first Williams made her way up north from Memphis, Tennessee, during the Great Urban Migration. Pittsburgh, along with Chicago, New York City, and Los Angeles, were major destination points for over a million African Americans weary of the arbitrary terrorism of the Jim Crow South. Like all immigrants, they plucked their lives from bitter soil and trusted that although they would not be arriving in a utopia, they would be transplanting them in a place where they would not face the daily threat of death and starvation that haunted them in the South. My family was no exception. Pittsburgh was actually the second stop in their flight from the rutted red clay roads and sun-fried cotton fields of Jefferson County, Mississippi. After a younger Williams brother's head was nearly severed by a shotgun blast when local white landowners determined blacks had no right to property, our family fled their successful farm at gunpoint with only the things they could carry or tow, landing hundreds of miles up the Mississippi in Memphis. When Memphis proved as precarious as Mississippi, the next move was due north to the industrial promise of Pittsburgh's mills. My great-grandaunt, Esther O. Williams, who in every breath and deed manifested this appellation, was number 18 of her mother's 20 surviving children. And along with her clothes and pistol on that last trip from Memphis, she carried with her the dream of becoming a teacher. But as the primary breadwinner of the recently transplanted clan, she took what work she could get, eventually coming close to realizing her dream by working as a custodian in McKelvey Elementary School on Bedford Avenue, a mere three blocks from her Morgan Street home. By the time I was born, she had amassed a collection of discarded textbooks, forming a sunroom library in the tiny space off her lower-level dining room, which led to her back door. I would stand in the narrow L-shaped corridor, running my small chewed fingertips over their dusty spines, science and history, reading and handwriting, and stacks of Ellery Queen mysteries. Today, I realized that my auntie was a hoarder, but in my young mind, her home was a buffet of possibility, and I was always hungry. I usually went for the basal readers, attempting to answer the comprehension questions after reading of the adventures of a blonde Dick and Jane. But one day, remembering her well-penned flourish at the bottom of the Mellon bank checks she fed to the pneumatic tube on our weekly trips to the drive-thru, I wanted to learn how to write my name in cursive as well. I could already print my name, but print was crude. It was easy. It did not demand the commitment of a script word. The marriage that took place between utensil and page could not be broken, must be balanced, must move forward with very few back steps until the end. I opened the squat metal school supply cabinet, which faced the bookshelves, taking out a pad of elementary school paper and a sharpened Dixon Ticonderoga Laddie. The thick blue and dotted red lines invited me to explore. The chunky navy pencil with its sharpened tip promised miles of script. Its unsullied pink eraser promised forgiveness if I made any mistakes. Carrying them both to the dining room table, I climbed onto a creaking chair, opened the handwriting textbook, and began. I started with a curve up, a rabbit ear, mirrored at the bottom. Continuing the trail was ahead, followed then by a little hill, three in fact, a blade of grass, two daisy petals, and another head at the end. Then I went back and put a drop of rain right above the grass. I was three. I don't remember exactly how she reacted after my silence prompted her to come downstairs from her afternoon shows to investigate. What did she make of the shaky graphite shapes, not quite aligned with the strokes underneath? The clumsy erasures smudging and boring holes in the yellowing paper. Knowing Esther, she probably said the same thing that I, now in my 19th year of teaching, say to my students. Good, keep going. The next piece I'm going to read is another piece that is connected to some of the more influential strong women in my life. This one is about my grandmother, and it's a piece about getting my hair straightened. It's entitled This Marriage. Rat tail burrowing deep, pioneer in Mother Africa's lushness, your wizened fingers grasp the Congo in one hand, black and steel in the other, relic. I recoil from your touch, shoulders tense in anticipation of this marriage, blue magic and sweat. Through metal teeth, the color of rich soil, Europe emerges from tangled roots.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the writer Jamila Reyes. So I'm curious, Jamila, how do you navigate both genres? How do you decide, well, this piece is going to be nonfiction versus this piece is going to be poetry? When do you make that decision?
That's a really interesting question, because I have had some pieces that originally started as poems and I thought were poems, and then the piece said it's not a poem. It kind of told me that there was more to say there, so I would turn it into that, or I might have something that's a longer piece and it's just not working and I can't figure out what's wrong with it, and the reason why is because it's not supposed to be long. You know,
yeah.
So you sort of
let the piece tell you?
Yeah.
How do you know?
Like I don't. I just go with it and see what happens. And if I like it better, longer, then I go with that. And if I don't, then I try to see what's going on. I usually, you know, set it to the side, do some other things, and then come back to it after I've thought about other things for a while, like my Roku.
Right. Do you think that it depends on details? Like if a piece is asking for more detail, then maybe it needs to be longer or more history?
I do believe that that is the case.
Because in the Learn in Cursive piece, we have a great sense of place.
Yes.
And all this history woven in there. Did you have to do a lot of research, or was that oral history already in your family, all those stories?
I've actually done a lot of oral history research within my family, but I've also done other research connected to those facts that I have gathered from people in my family. My aunt that I spoke about in Learning Cursive, she was the matriarch of our family, and she actually raised three generations of people in our family, and she told us, she shared all of those stories with us of the migration life in the South, how they arrived in Pittsburgh, and then what their lives were like.
Mm-hmm. So do you sometimes feel like a reporter when you're doing nonfiction, like reporting about these histories, or do you tape record when they talk, or how do you gather all those notes?
I just listen and I write notes. I have so many notebooks, unfinished, finished, where I gathered that information. I did more recently start actually recording through audio and through video of older people in my family to get those stories so that then I can write based on that. And if anything really intrigued me and I wanted to know more about it, then I would investigate. And then if I couldn't get all the facts, then I would turn it into a fiction piece. Mm-hmm. Because I would have to imagine what fit in all the holes.
Yeah.
Like, how do you fill in those spaces when you only know one fact?
Right.
Yeah.
It would be neat to sort of see like a book that had a video component.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Here's a book of my, you know, nonfiction life and then the video recordings of my aunt at the end tucked in. That would be neat. But that's really interesting way to gather information and do research and decide, you know, is this a poem or is this a longer nonfiction piece?
Yeah. So learning cursive was like that. Originally, it started with the action of me writing my name in cursive, and then I added the backstory to it in order to lead up to, hey, and then I was thinking about my aunt and how much she wanted to be a teacher, but she couldn't because she did not have the resources to do so, and how important it was for her to make sure that I was so steeped in literacy. Mm-hmm. So.
That's great. Do you have more you'd like to read?
Yes, I do, actually. This next piece is a fiction piece that I wrote based on my great-grandmother. This is my maternal great-grandmother, and she was an interesting woman. I was not as close to her as I would have liked to be. And I always wondered why she had such a tough exterior. And as I did research, I found out or I discovered things about her life that caused her or that I thought might have caused her to be that way. And that's where I came up with this backstory for her based on the fact that I got when I was doing that research. So this is called A New Kind of Soft. That's it. The girl lifted her head from under the borrowed black straw hat. Too wide for her, the brim hid her narrow brown forehead. She took her time to gently place it back on her newly straightened hair so the newspaper inside wouldn't fall out. The sun was high now, and she could feel her hair turning at her temples. She'd promised Aunt Pitt that she would keep the hat clean if she could just have something right for her mama. Not that the stranger in the surplus pine box ever did anything right for her, but she was still her mama, right? So she shouldn't even be thinking like this right now. She rubbed her hands dry and small, then studied her fingers, Godfrey fingers, perfectly oval beds, bright white moons, but a thin line of dirt remained lodged where the beds met the thin whiteness of her short nails. She bemoaned the dirt. It persisted, like the smell of fried bacon in your clothes on Sunday in church. It was impossible to remove. You either got used to it, worried over it, or eventually got so wrapped up in other things that you forgot it. Now it was all she wanted to get wrapped up in, the familiar dirt residing under her Godfrey nails. Anything but this new dirt enclosing the pine box. She tried scrubbing them with the nail brush this morning, but the bristles were too long to have that much of an effect. Then the babies needed to be washed, dressed, and fed, and she needed to wash and get dressed herself. She barely had enough time to stuff her feet into her outgrown brogans before Uncle Z started again. Oh, please, not today. She did and didn't want to hear it from him on the day her mother was put into the ground. But maybe this day of all days will be the day when Aunt Pitt will finally do something, anything. Maybe his acting up on the day of her older sister's funeral will be the fire she needs to finally speak up before she's put in her own pine box. Holding the wobbling chair still past the 20 minutes was hard on her narrow bottom. She got in a seat in a chair whose back right leg was partially in a hole she hoped wasn't a snake hole, and the sun was baking her legs, too long for her skirt, even though she was still small for her age. And she had to keep hold of the hat with one hand. It was all a study in balance. "Come on, Baby Hill. Time to go home. We got to finish all that food. Everyone's coming back to the house, and you know Lee and them always hungry. I don't see how we supposed to feed them all, but Lucky, Ma Sal, and I'm bringing some dishes along, too, so I guess we'd be okay. But you got to roll out and cut the biscuits as soon as we get back, start up the fire, change the babies, and give me that hat back. Lord knows what I'm going to do with you now. Marie gone for good. I always thought she'd come around and do what was right." Then her aunt shrugged her shoulders as if someone told her the store was out of eggs. The girl studied her, this woman who'd reluctantly been her mother for 3 years, her own mother, visiting on holidays. Those holidays flipped through her mind like a calendar sequence in her favorite cartoon, except in color. Bright red beaded dresses and rhinestone headbands reflecting all the colors of the Georgia morning. Impossible buttons and hooks in her intricate undergarments as Marie changed out of her good clothes into one of Pitt's old dresses to help with the cooking. In the next sequence, the parade of inappropriate gifts marched through. Itchy wool dresses and sweaters that always be too hot, doll babies that always be neglected, and shoes three sizes too small that always remind her of how much two people who look so much alike knew nothing about one another. Who was this woman who birthed her? What did she do? Why did she leave? Why did she come back? Where did she go and with whom? So many questions she asked of the ever-lowering casket while she looked in Pitt's wide, deep-set eyes and wondered what she was really feeling about losing a sister. Perhaps it was the look the girl gave her, but grief struck her aunt's tongue, and she continued to speak in streams, her hands fluttering while she spoke, to tug down dress sleeves over her ample upper arms, pull up falling stockings, push her silk hat further down on her head, fix her slip under the strained black and beige polka-dotted dress. Nothing fit right, but fit was never the point for Eva, Aunt Pitt Stinton. She always liked the idea of things more than their actual fruition. Her name itself was the incarnation of this fact. The perfectly balanced pair of dual syllabic names was an oxymoronic duo, fallen eyelash wish, compared to the actual woman representing the ingenue-like moniker. And now that Pitt's idea of her wayward sister Marie coming back to take her daughter Gertrude Baby Hill Godfrey with her up north was interrupted by Marie's untimely bout with pneumonia, that idea, then all others, began to rise up in her mind, spilling out over the seams of the compartments where she kept them. They were all scattered, and like all hoarders, Pitt went through them, yet couldn't get them all straight. It was too much. Gertrude's heart hovered in her budding chest. Like it suddenly sprouted wings, it was trying furiously to escape. It didn't hurt, though. Not really. Not much. Not a hurt like a fist in the face, not a hurt like feet after a long walk, not even a hurt like the first time that she called Aunt Pitt Mama and received a corrective slap. It was a new kind of hurt, a soft hurt. It was a new kind of soft. So it was then, there, while balancing that wobbly chair, that she realized soft didn't always equal good, like mushy peaches left too long on the branch or those that fell off early and were trodden underfoot. She, too, would not be claimed by anyone anymore because the last somebody who truly belonged to her was being lowered into the ground by her uncles as she reached this epiphany. She was 11, and she was lonelier than all previous todays. Her neck lost its stiffness, and she dropped her head into her hands. Tiny, perfect ovals with a hint of dirt cradled her newly dampened cheeks. A random June wind lifted the borrowed hat and gently placed it to the left of Uncle Z's foot, which he just as gently crushed with his newly grease-shined left black shoe.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the writer Jamila Rice. So I really like that you write about hair and clothes, and I think that that's a great way to sort of define a character. Sometimes characters are created through dialogue or through their situations with other people, but you really create a character through the description about clothes and hair. Is that something that you're drawn to just naturally, or where do those details come from?
Well, I think that clothes and hair definitely speak a lot to personality, of course, mm-hmm. you know, and whether the attention or the lack of attention, you know, tell you a lot about a person, at least to me, that's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always intrigued by people who really wear their personality in their hair mm-hmm. and in their clothing. And I just like seeing difference and, I guess, diversity and not this homogeneity that we tend to see a lot lately with, you know, labels and, mm-hmm. you know.
And I think that's interesting, too, because it is how you wear your hair is sometimes representative of who you want to be that day, even. Mm-hmm. But I never thought to sort of explore that in my own writing. So that's kind of inspirational. I really think that that piece that you just read creates a strong voice, too. Mm-hmm. You played a little bit with voice, bringing forth the character. Was that challenging? Or allowed you a sort of a new opportunity to play?
I think the latter, definitely. It did allow me a new opportunity to play. But there was a bit of a challenge in it because I wanted to try to be as authentic to the voice without turning this person into a caricature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is so easy, mm-hmm. you know, if you're not really being true to, like, who this person is who's actually speaking these words.
Right. And I think that happens a lot when characters are flat, mm-hmm. when there isn't a lot of other dimension, but you've created other dimension by describing sort of their interaction, her interactions, and how she looks, that I think that you earn that. So I wouldn't be worried.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. I also enjoy your metaphors. They're very interesting. Like, even in the Learning Cursive piece, you said buffet of possibilities, and I was always hungry, or as if someone told her the store was out of eggs. Those are all just very bright and fresh. Does that happen when you're drafting, or is that more of a revision thing that these interesting metaphors come out?
A lot of them happen when I'm drafting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I really try to do is I really try to immerse myself in whatever piece that I'm working on at the moment, and just try to feel it and, like, be there. It's like I am there mm-hmm. with the two. Like, what am I seeing as I'm looking at this young girl who is my great-grandmother, as she's looking at this woman who's her mother but who never was really a mother to her, being buried? Because, you know, there's always that hope, even though you know deep inside that this person really is not going to change. You still have that hope that things are going to get better. Mm-hmm. And her hope was dead, you know.
right.
I mean, literally. Mm-hmm. So what is she doing? And what's going on around her to affect what she's thinking.
Mm-hmm. But metaphors are hard sometimes. They're hard to, like, come up with fresh new ones or compare different things. In terms of, like, the real world. So I was definitely impressed by that. Do you have some poems that you could close out with?
I have...
Any hair poems?
Do I have a hair poem? I actually don't have any more hair poems.
You should write a series of hair poems.
I definitely should because, stories. Okay. So this poem is entitled Sister Betty Does the Wash, and it's for Sister Betty Shabazz, wife of El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X. And I'm not exactly sure, you know, what the timeline was for me as far as coming up with the idea to write this, but I think I was reading his autobiography, and was wondering, you know, what was going on at home when he was making, you know, the pilgrimage to Mecca. What was going on at home when he was doing all the other things in the community? And his wife, Sister Betty, was raising their daughters. So I just imagined again, like, what life was like for her. And this is it. People will ask you. They'll ask, what's it like? But they don't really want to know what it's really like, not your really like. They just want to hear their thoughts through your lips, conduit, vessel, to them, to him. This is evening talk, like that of the day. Isn't it wonderful just to be there? Be there, beware. Barely staring at mounds of hair to be combed, stacks of pots to be scrubbed, loads of clothes to be cleansed, your view obstructed, evidence of pleasures past. You pull a smile from your file of acceptable replies as questions linger, but you must love it. Love it. Love what? Love is scent tracing under things you sort, littering your neat, cramped bedroom's floor. The basket's weight waffling your forearm as you contemplate sweat stains. Perspiration postcards marking trips you've not taken. In the back room, you shift your swell off your bad right foot, stooping, sinking shirts into the given washer, praying it will be kind. Cool water sates shame for intact clothing calling Allah's name. Above briefs, shirts soak languidly, unevenly, sodden with suds, uplifted with air, corners and slightly frayed edges evading ablution. So you plunge your dark fists into the resistance, rubbing, churning, sluicing. Save the lone tea inside your yellowing pillowcase, just in case, just in case, just in case people say, weren't you blessed? I have another one. This one is a little off of the historical path. And I always have this fascination of the intersection of different disciplines to have a fresh look at a topic. So this one is entitled Mathematics. Outside of superheroes, singers, and condiments, duos quake singularity, terrorize certainties, unmolested mail stacks, haphazardly sealed snacks, and raggedy draws. See, one plus one never equal two or two to me, me and. Somehow math lost all function with the addition of a conjunction. But we, through your lips, over your tongue, multiplied by prepositions, sweetens the proposition, making a probability a given.
Thank you. The poetry and writings of Jamila Rice. Thank you so much for being here. It was great to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 FM.